Welcome to Survival Mode Disrupted, the podcast for those who are done performing, done people pleasing, and done living life on autopilot. I'm your host, Leticia, the Survival Mode Disruptor, and this is where we create disruptive, unapologetic transformations for those who are ready to exit survival mode and reclaim their power. Every episode is your permission slip to burn the rule book, break the cycle, and finally build a life that feels like yours. So let's disrupt everything that's holding you back and start living life on your own terms. Welcome to Survival Mode Disrupted. This is your trigger warning. This podcast contains unfiltered conversations about trauma, abuse, and survival. Discretion is advised. This is not therapy or medical advice, just real people sharing real stories. So please take care of yourself and pause if you need to. If this conversation hits home, grab the book Survival Mode Exit Plan, your raw, unapologetic blueprint to break free. Available now by scanning the QR code or clicking the link in the comments. Hello, 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 and welcome back to Survival Mode Disrupted. I am your host, Leticia, the Survival Mode Disruptor. And today I have Casey. Casey, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, thank you so much for having me, Leticia. I appreciate it. My name is Casey Kang. I am a three-time survivor of acute lymphoblastic leukemia. Wow. And now I'm a trauma-informed cancer coach.
Okay, I love this. I don't love what you've been through, even though I haven't heard this story yet, but tell us what your journey to and through survival mode looked like.
I'll start from the beginning. So I was 31 years old and I was diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia. And the minute your ears hear cancer, everything, the noise just disappears. And this pit drops from your stomach and you go into survival. It's like instantaneous. And you're like, am I gonna die? And the doctors try to reassure you that you're not going to die. But that from that moment on, you're just like mitigating disasters after that. And so because of what I was diagnosed with, which is typically a children's cancer, you go through an 18-month protocol that the first induction phase, because it's so aggressive, you're getting like three or four different chemos at the same time, you're hospitalized for the first 30 days. So you're like literally surviving every day with doctors and tests and procedures and just trying to like not freak out. And even though you're freaking out because you're like, what's happening, right? And so I get out of the hospital. I'm still going back to the back for appointments like three or four times a week at least. And 4 months into that, I had a stroke from the chemotherapy that I was given. So that was like the most humbling experience that I've ever had in my life, to be so completely helpless. I was temporarily paralyzed on my left side. So I had to go through another almost month of hospitalization to relearn how to function, basically walk, talk, eat, think, because your cognitive ability is really, really skewed. And then I did 8 weeks of outpatient rehab, 5 days a week, 3 hours every single day. And it was brutal. And literally still getting chemotherapy because I wasn't in remission. So I'm doing all this at the same time. And everyone's like, well, how did you get through it? I go, I had no other choice. I had to learn how to use my left side again, despite the pain, despite like all the things that were happening. And so I finished my 18-month protocol. I'm going to fast forward us. I had 7 weeks of remission and I got the news again that my cancer was back. And this time they told me my body was no longer responding to chemotherapy. So did I want to go on a clinical trial or an immunotherapy that had just came out and approved? And I was like, okay, after some debate and discussion, we went with the immunotherapy first because it didn't negate me from the clinical trial. And the immunotherapy almost killed me. It sent me into a cytokine release storm, which is basically when your body starts to attack itself to because there's something foreign in it. So it's like shutting itself down. I come out of that somehow. We were supposed to go to a clinical trial. I did all the testing, all the procedures to do it, and a week before I was supposed to go on it, it got shut down. So I'm in the hospital now for like 60 something days, and I'm like, I need to get out of this. Can I leave? I promise to come back as many times as you want, because we have no other options right now. There was another clinical trial going on at a different hospital, but there was a wait list, and I could read between the lines of what my doctors are saying was they have different procedures and protocols for what qualifies somebody for this clinical trial, and we don't know if you're going to qualify. And I was like, that sounds like it, I'm not going to qualify. That's not great. And there's no line skipping with a clinical trial, so you just have to wait. So I was like, there's got to be something, right? There's got to be something. So the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society's annual doctors conference had just ended. My oncologist said, do you want to try this? Hands me two pieces of paper. It's an immunotherapy, not for my cancer. And I'm just sitting there like, the outcomes were not good. 114 participants, 11 had the cancer that I had, and a lot of them didn't make it. So I'm sitting there going, I had an immunotherapy that almost killed me. Now you want me to try this and it's not for my cancer. What are we talking about? Like, is this where we're at? Like, really? And so, I talked with my now ex-husband at the time and decided I just one day I woke up and I said, you know what? Sounds like I'm not going in a very positive direction anyways. I'm just going to get there sooner, but at least maybe this data will help save someone else's life. And that's all I thought about and was like, okay, maybe somebody else can live because of my death. And that was it. And I decided, I told them we're going to do it. And we wrote a letter of compassion to the FDA and to the drug manufacturer to get access to it. And I was sent home and to wait. I planned my funeral. I planned for my now ex-husband to be living with someone else and have another life and all of these conversations that you never thought you'd have, let alone be having them at, I was only 33 at the time. And we got approved, which thankfully after a couple months, and then I went into remission from that drug, thankfully, after four rounds, did a stem cell transplant. So more chemotherapy, more radiation. 6 months in my recovery, I relapsed again. And they told me it was back. And because again, it was a very aggressive cancer. My cancer doesn't have stages, but I couldn't surmise that it was probably a stage four. At this point, and I wanted to give up. I did. Like in that moment, I was like, I can't keep doing this. I'm exhausted. We're going on like year four at this point. Like, I don't have it in me. And because they wanted to do more immunotherapy and then go into another stem cell transplant. And I was like, I just don't have it. I cried. And the minute I was like, I can't do this, the voice in my head was my dad, and he's like, your dad would be so disappointed in you. And I was like, oh, that guy. And so I was like, okay, fine, one more time. But this isn't for me. This is for everyone that got me to this point because, like, people moved mountains to do this. And that was it. And that's when I made my deal with the universe. So I was like, fine. I go, I'm one more time, but you're either going to kill me or you're going to let me live. I'm not doing this for the rest of my life. And now I'm in my 7th year of survivorship. So it was a very wild time to say the least.
So much is going through my mind as you tell this, right? Like, cancer at 31, a stroke as a result of your cancer treatment, then in remission for 7 weeks. What was the time period for the second remission? 4 months?
I didn't reach remission at all during after the second time. So like the I reached remission enough so that they can do a stem cell transplant. How much in remission, I don't know, because they were just like, immediately, we're doing this. We've got a very small window. So maybe 2 weeks
Wow.
before the stem cell transplant. And with engraftment, with a stem cell transplant, it's like an organ, same thing as an organ, just with my blood instead. Your donor has to take over. And I never, my donor didn't take over, their cells didn't take over inside of my body until long after my relapse, the third time.
Wow. What? I mean, you spoke a little bit about your mental state during this period, but can you go into a little bit more detail about like what this looked like for you? Like you, I mean, this is survival mode in its purest form. Like you were literally fighting for your life for years.
So for me, like I realized very quickly, and I think it's because I was hospitalized for 30 days then initially, that I have zero control over this. My time, my everything, I have zero control. But what can I control, right? So that's when I started to shift the narrative, right? Like I walked every day in the hospital and did the recumbent bike because I was so depleted and deconditioned. Even after such a short period of time that I needed to build all of that back up, I was like, they're not gonna let me out of the hospital unless I can get upstairs, right? Because I have stairs in my house. So I was like, oh, I gotta do that. I have control over when I can shower, right? Because at first you don't. Their nurses are like, we have to unhook you and unhook you. And I was like, I can't deal with that. So you just start bringing like the IV pole in the shower, right? Like you stop waiting for permission from people and you just start taking like, what can I do? And so then that carried on into when I got sent home, and the same mentality of what can I do? So I started again walking even further and to try and build up stamina and strength again. I made it a point to get out of bed every day and shower. I didn't sleep, take naps in my bed. They were for sleeping, right? Like I made it like rules for myself with the little control that I had. And I think that mentally helped a lot because you literally, I had no control over what my body was going to do every day, what it could do, but I could control certain things.
Absolutely. So if you don't want to go here, it's fine. But previously, when we were talking, you spoke about your life prior to cancer. And your summation of why you got cancer in the first place. Do you mind discussing a bit?
No, I think it's important. So I had a very traumatic childhood. There's a lot of physical, mental, and emotional abuse that was happening for 10 years straight. And then because I wasn't healing or wasn't doing work on myself, I took that same mentality of anger, of resentment towards the people that were doing it into my life in my 20s, making decisions based on a dysregulated nervous system. So I'm like checking boxes of life, working over 50 hours a week, completely stressed out, but not realizing it. 2 hour commuting every day, binge drinking on the weekend, trying to live this life that I'm supposed to live and not realizing the damage that I was doing internally, living that way.
It's interesting because there's two levels of damage here, right? The one that was created as a result of the trauma that you experienced that then essentially lived in your body. And then, well, actually, three, the stress of your job environment, the stress of the emotions that you were holding on to. And then on top of that, you're binge drinking, probably, and I'm taking a guess here, you can correct me if I'm wrong, to negate the emotions that you were still dealing with.
You nailed it, Letitia. Like 100%, that's what I was doing because I didn't want to feel. I didn't want to go there. I didn't want to, I was taught feelings are scary and vulnerable and unsafe. Don't feel those things. Stop crying. Stop feeling. Stop. I was like, I don't, how do I turn it off?
Yeah, it's very difficult to turn it off with all tools. So I guess what I'm trying to understand, were you able to deal with the emotional stuff prior to your diagnosis, your first diagnosis?
Absolutely not.
Ooh, girl. So you carried all of that baggage into your fight for your life.
Yeah. I think that's the lesson I didn't learn the first time. It wasn't until I relapsed again that I was like, what do I need to be doing? Because everything's got to change. Because I can't keep. I knew I was breaking during the midst of my treatment the first time. Like I was on edge constantly. I was yelling at people for no reason, like especially my ex-husband. He bore the brunt of it, I could feel the agitation, the constant, like it was constant. There wasn't a time during that period when I was like, I know I need help. I don't know how to get it and I don't know where to look for it. It took me like 6 months to find a therapist even that specialized in cancer. Because I was like, something, there's something going on. I don't know what, but it's not, I'm not, what I'm doing is not working, right? Because I, there was a point after, during my first journey with cancer, the 18-month protocol, I went back to work 50 hours a week, 2 hour daily commute, right? Like, I didn't learn the lesson at all. So I think this was the universe's way to be like, you gotta change some stuff if you wanna live.
Yeah, and that's what we do, right? Like that is the basic overall theme of survival mode. It's like we're not addressing anything. We just go on. We just go on with life and we are in autopilot. Like you probably were as you drove this 2 hours every day, right? Like it's you just do what you need, what needs to be done. And it, yeah. I'm aware of the emotions, but I'll wait till the weekend to deal with that. And you just go on. So what changed? What changed for me? You said you recognized you went to therapy, but what changed for you on an emotional level that allowed you to exit survival mode that you probably had been in since childhood?
Oh, yeah. I think I realized that that way of living wasn't serving me. That cutting myself off from the world even further wasn't what I need to experience, right? I had all these emotions building up for 30 something years and I didn't know what to do with it. And when they came out, oh boy, there were times where I was like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to hold this. And I think without my therapist at the time going, it'll pass. It's okay. You've got to go through it, feel it to let it go. I was like, okay, I'm trusting that you're going to guide me in the right way and not hurt me even more because there were more so many sessions in therapy that I left feeling utterly devastated walking out and like more traumatized almost in a way. That's what it felt like than walking in. And I was like, I'm voluntarily doing this to myself because I knew there had to be a better way, a different way, and I had to get through that ugly part.
Yeah, it's the ugly part, that journey. And it does feel like you're re-traumatizing yourself because oftentimes, you manage to, I think the brain is very smart in the way that it compartmentalizes, right? And I've experienced this where, I had a period of molestation that until I wrote my book, I forgot about.
Right?
And then you go through this process of talking to somebody, and I'm recognizing all of these triggers that I didn't recognize before because I'm becoming more aware of how my emotions are impacting me. But discussing that for the first couple of times was hella traumatic. And it was probably more traumatic as an adult than it was as a child, because as a child, all I wanted was attention. So the attention that I was getting in that sense ticked a box. Now I'm trying to heal, and Lord, now I'm gonna deal with all of these emotions. They ain't ticking their boxes. You know what I mean?
No. And like that's the thing, like when I first started there with my therapist, she actually was the one who pointed out that what I experienced as a child was trauma, was abuse. I didn't think, and I was like, she's like, that's abuse. And she like literally said it like that. And I was like, what do you mean? And she like literally regurgitated what I had just told her. And I was like, oh, I didn't even categorize it as abuse. I thought that's just how people grew up. So to really have that be told to you, I'm like, oh, that changes the narrative instead of everything.
And I've heard that in these discussions, right? Like women going through some really hard shit and not identifying it as trauma. And this is all showing up in your body, but you don't have the awareness that you've been traumatized. You don't have the awareness that you are operating in the residual impact of trauma because you've never even labeled it as that. So how do you heal from something that you don't even recognize, right? It's crazy. So, the listeners have probably heard me say this 100 times. I think that there are three phases to exiting survival mode. The first one being awareness, self-awareness. We cannot change what we cannot see or acknowledge. Reprogramming, changing the narratives, and then reinvention. It is letting go of the person you had to become in order to survive.
Oh my
I'm going
God.
to ask you a question. With the two areas of survival, what was, in your opinion, the hardest to recover from emotionally?
Oh, I would say letting go of the person that I thought I had to be or become because of everything that had happened, right? Like you identify as that person that is you, right? But when you unpack why you had to do those things or become that thing, like perfectionism and overachieving and all these things, you're like, oh, I was doing that because I of that. Oh my, and it totally changes the narrative, which is great to know, but then you're like, what do I do with this? So who am I, right? Who am I without the programming? That becomes like a whole nother journey where you're like, and that's really hard to figure out, right? Like, how
It's
do I figure out?
incredibly hard.
Yeah. Like, I can deal with the emotions and unpacking them, but then, like, I get to choose? Wait, no one's telling me? Oh.
I recognize that when I left my first husband, the only way that I had ever described myself was attached to the interpersonal relationships that I had. Right. So if somebody said, well, who are you? Oh, well, I'm so and so's child. I'm this person's girlfriend slash wife. I am this. And then when I left this situation, essentially being alone without my parents, without many of my friends, because nobody really knew what I was going through. And this man who I had been attached to for 8 or 9 years, I really didn't know who I was. And that to me was the scariest thing. Like, I know I have to make a decision, but how can I decide? And this is without tools, right? Like not having any tools to navigate this, I didn't know who I was. And I hear that with so many people that have been through, trauma. Who am I without that? Who am I without what I have come to know?
Right, 100%. And you question, you doubt yourself so much because somebody's been telling you who you are for your entire life that you're discombobulated. And I think for me specifically, like I was trying to achieve love through those relationships. I needed to love me first.
But we're not taught how to.
No, because the love is achieved through the people pleasing, the overachieving, the gold stars.
Perfectionism, like all of that. And again, this is something that's learned. And that's what's been really interesting about this process of learning how the residual impacts of trauma. Those personas to me were like mind blowing. Like at first I heard it, and like the person who was explaining it to me was like, some people show up as this, and some people show up as this, and some people show up as this. And I'm sitting there like, wow. I'm a bit of that. I'm a bit of this. I'm a bit of that too. I'm like a smorgasbord of personas here. And I don't know how to navigate that because I didn't understand where it had come from initially, right? Like understanding where overachievement comes from, that desire to be seen and accepted. So you do, you do, you do, you do, you do until you get the reward that you're looking for. And then it becomes a habit. Or recognizing that your actions aren't pleasing someone. So you start changing the way that you show up so that you aren't feeling rejected, right? Like, I want to make this person happy, so I'm going to do all of these things, even though my soul is screaming no. I'm going to do it because I need to be accepted and loved. I need someone to just take me as I am without recognizing we're not presenting ourselves as we are, right? We are changing our personalities, changing who we are to get that fulfillment from what we deem is lacking. So you go through all of this, Casey, and now you're 7 years in remission, and you say, you're not a trauma-informed coach. Tell me why that step was important for you.
I think it for me, it was personal. I really, really struggled with surviving, right? Like everyone's like, oh, once you're done, everything's gonna be sunshine and rainbows. This is basically what was told to me by other survivors. And I got done and I was like, my expectations did not match my reality. I was riddled with constant fear. I was a mess. I was like, how do I unpack this box? Like on top of all the other boxes that I have to unpack. And I was more miserable. I was so unhappy. I would have rather died than lived in that moment. And so, because I was like, well, how do I live life again? How do I try to reduce my risk of this happening again? And my oncology team was basically like, eat right and exercise. And I was like, that's not helpful. So that's when I started to really dive into nutrition and exercise. And, I have a postmenopausal body now at 34 years old. Like, what does that even mean? And then all of the reinvention part, like how do I find who I am, right? So like I just because of that is why I do what I do, because there's all these parts that are missing from your life that you're like, I'm not, there's life before cancer, there's life during cancer, and then there's life after cancer, but I don't know how to do the life after cancer. Because everything that I've known up to this point is so different. And it's not normal. So what does my new normal look like? And it's literally unpacking like, okay, well, what's the reinvention piece, right? What do you Do you want to be the woman who exercises every day? Do you want to be the woman who eats right and takes care of herself? Yes, 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 because you've been self-sacrificing yourself for decades.
That's self-sacrifice, man. Listen. Just listen. Excuse me. Casey, I have been thoroughly moved by your journey. Like, wow, you are incredible. I don't even want to use strong. You are formidable. And I celebrate your remission. I celebrate your life. I celebrate your desire to be impactful post reinvention, because I think it's just a beautiful thing. So how can the listeners connect with you?
I'm on Facebook and Instagram at The Happier Hustle. And please reach out, say hello. These are conversations that will literally can impact your life, and Leticia's leading the way with it.
Thank you. So before we wrap it all up, give us one key takeaway.
Oh my gosh. One key takeaway. You can have the perfect diet and exercise every day, but if you do not address what's in your head and your heart, you are still unhealthy in some way.
Listeners, it's time to get healthy. Casey, thank you so much for your time. Listeners, thanks for joining another episode of Survival Mode Disrupted. And I'm going to remind you, you were not built to break, but you damn sure were not built to just survive. Disrupt the cycle, reclaim your life, and thrive on your own terms. And I will see you next week.